All right, well, good afternoon. It is March 30th, 2013. I'm here with Mr. George Berg, and we're going to sit and talk about your experiences in the Vietnam War and serving in the Air. I guess kind of just to start out, where were you born? What was your childhood?
Well, I was born in 1939, to deliver the laundry back to them again. Ohio started to change for everyone. Yeah. As a child, don't ever remember going hungry. And that's one good thing.
I
went back about 10 miles away, and all the jobs were taken by those out of work. Two and one more than anything else. I just did the recruiting. I always wanted to fly airplanes. In fact, I did at that time. I was flying. But I just walked in and said, I want to sign up, which made them, it's like telling the encyclopedia salesman, please, I want to know. Volunteer, I could leave. This was on a Friday that I went in, and they said, well, the next train leaves on Monday. I said, put my name down. So then I went home and told my parents, and that was pretty bad scene there.
Didn't go
because
over
there was no military background in my family at all in this country that I know of. So I left on Monday. But what prompted me to join? Frustration. I couldn't find a job, and I needed money if I was to continue my college, which didn't happen at that time.
Didn't happen. I guess lost my train of thought there. Like, so, whenever you got to boot camp, what was it? Was it what you expected it to be? I mean, did you have? I guess you went in with zero expectations and just wanted to get out.
I had no knowledge what it was going to be, but they took me by train. They took us by train from Ohio up to Upper State New York, in the Finger Lake area they call it, which is beautiful under normal circumstances. But I was assigned to Samson Air Base, which no longer exists. And we were all recruits, and I didn't know what to expect, and I was shocked by it, because you look around, and in the barracks there are 80 people there too, just like me. What's going on? So
and then so you stayed in, and you served all over the place, in Korea and in Turkey and in Germany, and you were stationed all around. What prompted you to stay in, I guess? Because you then became, you came in, and from my understanding of the sheet, you became an officer.
Well, right away. That took some leading up to. First of all, I wanted to fly as a kid. I soloed my first aircraft when I was 16 years old. Not my aircraft, but then a gentleman in my hometown. And flying, I guess, as the saying goes, was in my blood. I wanted to stay in, and of course, the recruiters, along with my commander, said, oh yes, we'll put you in pilot training. So that kept me in.
So you were 16 when you flew the first time?
Yeah, but not in the Air Force.
Not a civilian aircraft. But kind of like as a person who's never flown an aircraft before. You just knew it was meant to be, and you loved it.
Yeah, it scared the heck out of me, to be honest. But no, it was an old biplane, a Stearman biplane, and Mr. Spademan, who's long since passed away. First of all, took me in the hangar and showed me two aircraft that had crashed. And then he asked me if I still wanted to fly, and I said, yes, sir. So he put me in the back seat, put me in the front seat of the Stearman, and we went up and flew around, and I didn't regurgitate, which I guess was a good sign, and brought me back down. And about three flights later, he crawled out of his seat and said, take it. I'm scared to death. I mean, this is the time when he said, I really am not sure about myself. But after I accomplished the 3 or 4 landings, then I became quite cocky about the whole thing. then I would say, yes, this was fate, this was meant to be.
I can only imagine getting behind the wheel of a car at the age of 16 was frightening enough, but in an airplane by myself.
Well, I drove at 15, so.
Yeah, it's old news, old hat. So I guess I have to ask, because you mentioned that you were married whenever you went into Southeast Asia already. Right. You're married with four kids, you're married to Anne. Like, how did you two meet, I have to ask? And what did she think of you being in the military? Is she from a military background, or?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was in the military for a couple of years before I married Anne. In fact, I came back from Korea and got married. But anyway, going to Southeast Asia, no. We knew it was inevitable because the war was not really going too well, I guess you might say, at that time. And I was a pilot, so I mean, put two and two together, and it spelled Vietnam.
Yeah.
But and I had flown there before the war, so I mean, I was not familiar with the area, but I knew what I was getting into or what they were putting me into. So.
Yeah.
And so far as the family goes, no, it was hard for them.
Yeah.
It was hard to explain why. Why your husband was leaving and why your father was leaving. So.
Yeah. Especially in a war as complicated as Vietnam.
That's a very good way of putting it. For it was very complicated.
How old were your kids at the time whenever you went over to Vietnam?
Well,
they were itty bitty.
Yeah. Golly, Ned's now. I have to go back. John would have been. Give me a moment to think about that, because I'm trying to put where we were and how old we were. And when I first went in, we were basically. See, John was born in Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
And that puts him the youngest of the troop. And that was in 62, I guess. So he was quite young, we'll put it that way.
Yeah.
And Carol, being the oldest one, she could explain to the other ones.
Yeah.
She was the second mother of the family. But insofar as age goes, from Carol on down, they were exactly 18 months apart,
okay.
Except for John. He was about 24 months later, but they were close enough in age to understand basically the same thing.
Same, yeah.
But it was still a very difficult thing to do.
Sure it was.
But again, we knew it was coming. I mean, it wasn't like the postman is here with your orders, pack your bag. So, if I may interject, my missions before Vietnam were such that I did have a bag packed at the foot of the bed.
Yeah.
And I would get a call at 2 in the morning, and I would grab the bag, jump in the car, and the family would not see me for maybe a month or even 2 months at a time. Returning, I couldn't tell them where I was or what I had done. So. Separation was part of the game, we'll put it that way.
Yeah. You were prepared for it, but it was still fairly difficult.
Yeah, you might say you're prepared for it. Yeah. You're really not. But
it's as prepared as you can be in those
right.
sort of situations.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. We try and bolster each other up, and
thanks
to Anne, she kept me pretty well bolstered up.
Anne was your support. She's lovely.
Oh, yeah.
She is lovely. I can see why you like her.
I like her, yeah. Like 58 years now.
That's quite a long time to be with. Quite a long time to be with.
I can't say that because Carol said, well, let's see, Dad, that would make me, 58. I said, yes, it would, Carol.
It's like, shh, that can't happen. And, kind of on your missions, I know that some of it is classified, but what, I mean, were you dropping supplies whenever you were in Korea and in your former missions? Were you doing, like, because I know that the 315th Air Division basically did everything. It was kind of a variety of things that they did.
That's true. Mm-hmm. And they developed as the war went on. Yeah. And proceeded to try this type of Ossetimbron. Mm-hmm. But these were short, tedious. Yeah. The Phuket had line flew in a bicycle path in the middle of the jungle.
Yeah.
Typically, no other way to describe it. And then I got orders to go to this place called Phuket. I thought, gee, that's ridiculous. But by the time I got there, the army engine, it was beautiful. I mean, not beautiful. What I thought it would be, yeah, it was beautiful.
Yeah, for sure.
And that was my last assignment.
Yeah, Phuket. And a lot of time that they got off the plane in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Is that striking to you? Getting off Moat Lai.
Oh, yeah. I got off the airplane at Tan Son Nhut in Saigon. I was picked up by an Air Force and taken into Nam Doi. Now there were no shells going off and no bombs going off. And it
really?
It was very colorful. Especially when your own airplanes went boom. Yeah.
And then, did you fly a lot into combat? I guess you flew a lot into combat zones while
yes.
you were doing ammo dumps.
No, always in combat zones. You're doing different things.
Yeah.
You're delivering different things. We had missions that we called TAC-E, or Tactical Emergency. And this was supply. Somebody was running out of ammunition, or they need another weapon of some sort or another. And they would wake you at 2 o'clock in the morning, and by the time you got out to the runway, your aircraft was already loaded with that. And you took off and you went to some place that you'd heard of before, or maybe you never had heard of before. And you were guided into it, and hopefully you could land there.
Yeah.
But, it was a supply thing, really.
Okay, yeah.
Air supply, ground supply, we delivered it by different methods.
Yeah.
I don't want to go into all of the leaps, plaids, jeeps, different types of landing things that we developed during the war.
Yeah.
Because of the circumstances, it said, hey, we can't do that anymore. We get shot up too badly. Let's try this. So.
Yeah. But, you're more than welcome to go into as much detail.
The aircraft was designed, they call it a 463L. Boy, it's coming back. The floor, the bed of the C-130, the back of the C-130, which is about 10 wide and 40 feet long, was rollers, roller conveyors. Upon which you could put pallets, and these pallets were about 7 by 7. The exact measurements escape me now, but these pallets would be loaded with whatever you wanted, you know, and strapped down with webbing and all that. And we started off by just, if we were under fire while landing, you would go as quickly as you could, really quick, to the end of the runway, and you would turn it around 180 degrees, and in doing so, the loadmaster, God bless him, would release all the locks on these pallets so that you would gun the engine and the thing would jerk and he said would just roll out.
Oh, that's so cool. That's ingenious.
Yeah, well, that worked initially.
Yeah.
And then the enemy decided that's the way they're going to do it. This is what we're going to do.
Yeah.
So we had to develop different methods of landing with a parachute and to pull those. Anyway, you get that close to the ground, you're liable to get shy.
A lot of trial and error as far
yeah,
as.
Yeah, that's true. That's
a lot of yeah. trial and error. And, trying to figure out what worked best, how can
yeah.
I keep my...
How many did we lose on that one? But the idea was to get the product to the people who needed it, and they were the ones, like I said, the grunts were the ones doing the war.
Grunts on the ground.
We were just supplying them, you know.
Yeah. What was your most... Do you have a most memorable trip out, a most memorable mission? I know that there was one where your helicopter was, or your plane was shot down.
Well, he was shot up too.
Shot down.
No, that was at Quezon.
Yeah, Quezon.
And that was a Marine base, and it was due west of Da Nang, and it was just another bicycle path. Mm-hmm. Held fervently by the Marines and wanted fervently by the VC. supplying them was very, very difficult because you're taking crossfire from elevated positions on both sides. And I had gone in twice successfully, bing, 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 bing on the aircraft, but got to the end of the, we were the last ones in to pick up the CCT, the combat control team, which were Army personnel with radios, and they were the ones directing aircraft to come in or to go away. And they were the last ones out. I went to the end of the runway, and I communicated with them, because this is what I'm going to do. The tail will be down, you guys get ready to run, because I'm not slowing down a heck of a lot here. And I got to the end of the runway, turned around, these guys ran and dove into the back end of the aircraft, pulled them in, started off going down the runway to take off, and they started to walk the borders down the runway. And I thought, well, hell, I've come this far. So I got, I'd say maybe 1,000 feet. Yeah, I'm not kidding. And I didn't quite make it. A mortar hit the tail of the aircraft, blew it off. And nothing caught fire, nothing exploded. But the aircraft veered violently to the right into the minefield. And we blew up three landmines over there. And we came to a bloody stop, you might say, as the Brits might say. And my co-pilot was very cool. He said, "That was great, boss. What are you going to do for an encore?" And being cool, I said, "I'm going to try and lead everybody out of the minefield as quickly as possible." Which we did, and you didn't have to tell anybody to be quick. But we all went. I had a crew of 5, and we were picking up 7. So the dozen, the dirty dozen, made it to the runway and revetment there. And I had a 123 flying cover, as we always did there. That's a twin-engine aircraft. Recip, and he came in with his tailgate down, the same basic configuration of a 130, but smaller.
Yeah.
But we all ran and got on that, closed up and took off, and got off without any incident. No one was even injured. Sideline, on the way to Da Nang, being the previous aircraft commander, and you know, I was in control of all this thing. Oh boy. I started to shake so bad, I can't sit on my hands. Anyway, just think of how close we had all come. But anyway, we made it. And we got back to Da Nang, and the first thing they do is give you a shot of whiskey, which my co-pilot didn't drink, so I had his too. And I was looking around if there was anybody else leaving theirs on the bar. But anyway, that was the most interesting, shall we say, mission that I had. Mm-hmm. But thank God we all made it. Poor aircraft. And, as a sign, I must admit, the wife and I were at one of the bookstores, large bookstores, and she went off on her search for a book or something, and I found a coffee table book, Vietnam, then I started going through it, you know. And I would say in about the midsection, here's a picture of an aircraft that I've written with the tail over here. And anyway, way over there. And that was my aircraft. And I thought, God, who would have taken the picture? Because we were the last ones there before the VC took over.
Yeah.
And, you know, I tried to contact, well, I did contact, it was put out by Time Magazine.
Yeah.
And I tried to contact them to find out who might have taken. They had no idea that it just showed up, I guess, one day. And, well, you know, the photo they put to whoever took the
caption,
darn
thing, yeah.
You know, whatever it is, there wasn't anything on it. But, excuse me. But, no, and Ann said, do you want to buy the book? I said, absolutely not. No, that's just...
Yeah, I was there. I don't need a picture book to remind me.
Yeah, that was a choke picture.
Yeah.
But that was it. I don't mean to get emotional. I'm not that way, but some things do bring up memories.
No, it's understandable. And then you...
Also, you know Barbara Walters is retiring, in case you want to move into that.
I did not know Barbara Walters was retiring.
I did not know how old she was either. I'm sorry, are we being recorded?
It's all good. Yeah, no.
She's
no.
82 or 83. My Lord.
She's been around the block a few times.
Well, she stopped a couple of times. Yeah.
And you were a unit commander.
Yes.
How did you keep your boys motivated? How did you keep them focused? And I mean, I can imagine as a unit commander in such a complicated war where a lot of people didn't really know what. Why they were there, and
that's it. A lot of questions were raised like that. First of all, the unit, we had a total of three units,
mm-hmm.
one in Da Nang, mine in Phu Cat, in Tonson, all of which had 16 aircraft.
Yeah.
The aircraft, without exception, were all old. There were things that were kids used to read about in the books, you know. They sat like this. They didn't sit like this. But anyway, they sat at an angle. I, being the commander, was the only one in the squadron that was older than the airplanes. And these poor kids came over. Now, these were not dumb kids at all.
No.
They were educated. They were all linguists. By and large, they were all linguists, several different languages. But anyway, to keep them motivated, well, shucks, we had ball games, we had volleyball games, we had football games, we had, you know, anything that required people, not required, but made available to them competition, and they loved it. You know, they would get out and beat the heck out of each other. But you know, it was a release.
Yeah.
But motivation. I had the two double-story barracks full of enlisted personnel. And being military, you know, they were run down.
Yeah.
And they needed paint. And I got this idea, and I got my first sergeant in, God bless his soul. And I said, why don't we have a painting competition? And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, these barracks need some paint, indoors and outdoors. And I said, why don't we just get some paint and some brushes and all that and turn it over to them and let them paint their own area and paint their own barracks. So where do we get the paint? I said, well, you leave that up to me. Like, I didn't know later. But anyway, I went down to the civil engineering department and I told the young lieutenant down there, I said, you know, this friend of mine needs some paint. Well, how much? I said, oh, probably about 80 gallons of paint. He said, my lord, what are you going to paint? I said, oh, some areas around here that do need paint. It makes you look good, you know? He said, it won't cost you any money and we'll use our personnel. And lo and behold, he got the shipment of paint in about 2 weeks. And I had a commander's call. And we called them all together. And I said, you know, at the end of my course, the commander's call. And I said, this is what we're going to do, guys. And I said, do it at your own pace. But I said, we only have one caller, I'm sorry. But I said, let's see if we can brighten this place up a bit. And boy, they thought that was pretty good. We had brushes all over the place. And kids that had never held a paintbrush in their life got in there. And we painted each other. We painted the barracks. We painted picnic tables. Anything that didn't move got painted.
Even some things that did move, yeah, I'm sure.
And we got all done. And we were the nicest looking two barracks in the whole darn base. And the kids were proud of.
That's ingenious.
Yeah. But anyway, but you're talking about questions. Yeah, really, we had a lot of questions. What are we doing here? What are we accomplishing? I'll tell you, the big question is, why must I wear a hat? Now, this is a military thing. And, sir, do you really think that I can do my job better by wearing a hat? And my explanation always was, son, you joined the club. Voluntarily, you joined the club. One of the rules of the club is you wear the stinking hat. Now, you know, there's no way you can get out of the club right now. If you just wait your time, you'll get out of the club and take off the hat and burn it. I don't care. But I said, as for right now, club rules prevail. So, oh, okay. So they put the hat on. We did go into baseball caps, but they decided no, they didn't like baseball caps, so they wore the regular Air Force hat. So
all things.
But no, that was motivation was not that difficult, really. I mean, they were all in the same boat.
Yeah.
We had linguists, we had translators, we had. Well, different classifications and things. But they all seemingly enjoyed what they were doing, except the flights. I mean, we were over combat territory. And, but with the exception of one, we had no incidents. So. Anyway. Next question, Senator.
Your next question, Senator. You received a Purple Heart, is from what I noticed, and I'm trying to fish out that story. Your grandson, Chase, is like, yeah, Grandpa Berg is always telling us the story about how he got his Purple Heart, so.
I didn't know how it was. I tried not to. Well. Okay, the one I got is by virtue of action in Vietnam.
Yeah.
At 1:30, I came out of Tachikawa, Japan, flying our precious load of Stars and Stripes and blood. And those were the two big things, because the general had to have his Stars and Stripes in the morning. Anyway. Coming in at high altitude, about 24,000 feet. And before I started my letdown, there was a massive explosion. We were pressurized, of course. There was a massive explosion off the right wing. And instantaneously, by virtue of the fact that parts of the ground-air missile penetrated the aircraft, we were instantaneously at 24,000 feet, as opposed to we've been pressurized down to about 2,000 or 3,000.
Mm-hmm.
this makes all the air in you come out. I was immediately blind in the right eye. It was that quick. Plus, this is embarrassing. I was bleeding from the mouth, and I couldn't find the hole. What had happened was that in putting fillings in my teeth, as the military would do, they had somehow, or maybe they always did, left air pockets underneath the fillings. So that when that occurred, it was like bullets in your mouth. And they penetrated too, quite deeply. The other one, not quite so deeply. The pain was severe, so I knew I'd been shot by something, I couldn't figure out what. Anyway, blind and bleeding, we came back in and landed, and I received immediate medical care and all this and that, but I could only see out of one eye, but I made a good landing. So I figured I normally had both of them closed when I made a landing, so no, I didn't mean it. The adrenaline was flowing pretty severely, but that was that Purple Heart.
Mm-hmm. So I was looking through the paper, and that was immensely helpful. Thank you, Dr. Greger, to figuring out kind of what to ask. And I saw you had a Purple Heart and the Distinguished Flying Cross, I believe, was the.
Yeah.
The DFC, had to look up a lot of acronyms as well. The military loves those. But the DFC, what did you, like, is there a particular incident that you've rewarded that for? Or, like?
To answer your question simply, yes.
Okay.
It was.
Yeah.
And it's in a write-up somewhere in the archives. I don't know where, but no, I just should not go into the reason. There were some things that were done.
Yeah.
That I did with permission.
Yeah.
But were very, very dangerous, to put it that way.
Yeah. Because I. Again, noted there are several things can't talk about, so completely understand.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing, we're going kind of back to the motivation of your unit and your people. You mentioned the two of the biggest things you had problems with was finding helping to motivate your unit, as
yeah.
well as drugs.
Yeah.
I know that those are two kind of big things that are found in common themes throughout the war across
yes.
every branch, every...
First time I had ever encountered drugs. I really didn't know that much about them. Yeah, I heard about them, but I had never witnessed anything. Very, very prevalent. Where do you begin with drugs? Let's go back to the barracks. We had, you might call them maid service. These people would change sheets probably twice a week and launder them and bring them back and put them on the beds. Clean, dust, sweep, all that. They also carried drugs. They were the transporter. The base commander, one time about 6 months after I'd been there, got all the indigenous personnel into the base theater, such as it was. And this occurred at about 7 or 8 o'clock at night. And it was lit, and he got all these Vietnamese in there. And he told them that he was going to turn the lights off for exactly 1 minute. During which time they were to get all the drugs off their person and inside their person or wherever they carried them, because when the lights came back on, they were going to be searched. And I mean physically searched.
Yeah.
And boy, I'll tell you, when they turned the lights on, we filled up 2 bushel baskets full of packets and vials and everything else. But anyway, we had an anti-drug thing. Well, again, here I am, novice. I have no idea about this. But Lord knows they gave me plenty of ammunition insofar as letters, documents, this is what you will do and all that. And one thing was to appoint the head of a drug investigation within your squadron. Well, we all knew about one guy. I mean, he was the ultimate. He was the leader of all this. So I appointed him to be the investigator. And everyone was, what? But he's the... I said, fine, and I want a report from you in about 36 hours. And I said, I want to see this thing cleaned up in less than a week. I don't want any more drugs, because we're going to get very severe about penalties. And before, I mean, the penalties were there, but they were never enforced.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he was in charge, didn't he? Damn good job, to not say that. The report was just fantastic, without naming names, but positions and all this and that. And also, what will happen when you pull these kids off those drugs overnight?
Mm-hmm.
And the severity of that escaped me until we did that. And then we got into a pretty serious tussle in a couple of things, and guy against guy, and all of a sudden. Again, my first Sergeant Payton, took care of getting those things calmed down. Sergeant Payton was 6'2", well, I'd say about 320, all muscle, sweet as can be, very intelligent, but had no time to waste on people with problems like that. So what they couldn't solve themselves, he would. And I never asked questions. Forced, probably so. But anyway, no, that was a big problem.
Yeah.
It really was. But it involved the whole box too. I mean, I know of a commander that was on drugs. He was a fighter. Anyway, no, drugs were so easily obtained. And they were inexpensive, really poor, so to speak. To the Vietnamese, boy, they retired early because they were getting paid regularly. But we put a stop to that, I think. As the war wound down, the drugs wound down also.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they, some of them carried them back to the States,
yeah.
Carried the requirement.
The habit, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, boy. No, I could have well done without drugs, I'll tell you. They did not affect, you know, I will say the one thing, they did not affect the mission.
Yeah.
No, they said, well, the kids were stoned. Well, I don't think so. I didn't see that.
Yeah.
What they would do, very briefly, let me explain the mission. We had the last mission. Well, I hate that. We would take off and fly in this old antiquated bird. Missions ranging from 6 to 8 hours,
yeah.
Continuous. In the back of this aircraft were 3 positions. 2 were intercept, and 1 was triangulation, we call them. But these intercept positions were tuned into Vietnamese, Chinese, Laotian, anything, Indian, English, anything that was over the radio. And this came out on a sheet of paper that they would type in and immediately hit a button and the triangulator would pinpoint the transmitter of that message. And if it were VC and plotted where the VC are, that was immediately transmitted to, in our case, an Indian or a Korean artillery unit, mm-hmm. who would shell that poor little receiver. I mean, it was quite successful. I don't know how many receivers we killed. I don't know how many VC, but
yeah.
Normally it took one VC per receiver. Anyway, but it was a very, very boring mission, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
We were flying normally at about around 14 to 2,000 feet, fairly low. Sometimes we took ground fire, but not much. But, and we would fly sometimes where we weren't supposed to fly.
Mm-hmm.
Not accidentally, we were told to go there. But these poor kids would sit back there and work. I met with two of them just a couple of years ago, Strickland, and I can't remember the other gentleman's name, who were back-enders. And they said they remember the first thing they remembered about me, and I'm not patting myself on the back or anything else, but I was up on an indoctrination flight. I had two pilots up there, and I was indoctrinating them. But anyway, so we took off, and gear up flaps up and all that. And I turned around to the guy right behind me, which was Strickland. He was the lead. And I asked him if I could get him any coffee. Yes, sir. And he had a 5-gallon jug, and I got some coffee, and I gave each one a cup of coffee on their way out. And I remembered that. I said, oh, no one ever did that. I said, why not? Don't you like coffee? Oh, no, sir. It was just the idea that you're the commander. Anyway. But that was the mission.
Yeah.
And it was, I guess, successful. We turned all the aircraft over to the Vietnamese.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the worst thing we could ever do to the Vietnamese. What are they going to do with all those old antiquated aircraft for which there were very few parts remaining? Because the aircraft were built in the 30s, early 30s.
Yeah.
31, 30 was a big year for C-47. Here, please, take our aircraft.
Please. We could go and buy new shiny aircraft.
Yeah.
And so you seem to have had a really, really good rapport with the guys you worked with.
Yeah, well, that's the way to get by. I mean,
yeah.
Don't baby them or anything else. And I kick rear ends. I don't know how deeply you want to go into one incident or another. But, we had one aircraft, because of bad weather, had to divert into an airfield in Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
Well, normally it seems okay, except that our aircraft always had to return home,
yeah.
because everything was taped, and it was immediately taken from the aircraft into our area, which was chain link, barbed wire, the whole bit, and we would do all the stuff and send messages all over the place. Anyway, because of weather, it had to divert and went into Thailand. Well, and it was either Ubon or Udorn, one of the two right on the border that they recovered at or landed at. They had to stay the night. Well, these kids have not been with a woman, shall we say, for months and months and months, okay?
Yes.
How it occurred, I'll never know. But two of the crew came back and came down with good cases of venereal disease. Okay, and of course, going to the dispensary having it diagnosed thusly was reported immediately. Okay, and it was taken care of. But anyway, the report went out. About 2 weeks later, my CEO came in from Hawaii, and I went through the dog and pony show, as you always do when the old man comes in. And he says, well, Burr, he says, so we had two cases of VD. I said, yes, sir, I did. He said, well, what'd you do? Give him an Article 15, which basically was a Chris Smith. I said, no, sir. He said, you court-martialed him. I said, no, sir, I did not. He said, Burr, what did you do? I said, well, sir, as long as these guys have been away from a woman, when I had commander's call, I briefed them on this and briefed them on that. And then I had these gentlemen get up and tell everything they could, blow by blow, what happened and how it was and everything else, and standing ovation upon completion, and that was it. He says, you know, he said, I figured you'd do something like that. I said, yes, sir. I said, it made them feel better. And, you know, what are you going to do? What had happened? Anyway, he didn't get mad at me, and he didn't meet me, so that was good, all fine. So. But, you have to learn to respect these kids. And they were kids. They had never been any further than their backyard, basically. And here they were in a foreign country doing a job, and, you know, using the training that they had acquired, but in a way they never expected to use it. So, and wearing their hats. And this god-awful uniform. But, I mean, you would perspire or sweat through a uniform probably two uniforms a day if you want to make an impression. But anyway, no, we got through it okay. Any other trouble spots you want to cover?
Oh, I was just going to ask about, like, no, please stop. If you'd like to take a break, we can. I have more questions. I'm always have more questions. Oh, but
up to you.
But I was going to ask, what was it like flying through monsoon season, or in monsoon season?
Oh, boy, they were so unpredictable. You never knew exactly what was going to happen. At one time, at 315th Air Division at Tachikawa, I was in charge of the command center. Mm-hmm. And we were in control of all the C-130 outfits in the Far East. It started out with the monsoonous Kawasaki effect, but anyway, I love that. But it started out going towards our base in southern the Philippines, hitting Mactan Island. And I had a squadron of B models, C-130 Bs. So contact commander had that squadron move immediately to CCK in Taiwan, Chinchong Kong, Taichung, whatever you want to call it. But anyway. So we moved that squadron to there. Now that placed four squadrons in Taiwan. And of course it went through, hit Luzon, Clark, and I had to move the 118s out of Clark, which were the Uribac aircraft. And I moved them to Naha and Okinawa. Then the monsoon turned a little bit to the left, to the west, and headed straight for CCK. So there you have, got four squadrons there. So I gave the order and evacuated all of them. They went all to Okinawa, to both Kadena and Naha, the two bases. And they decided, no, we don't want to go that way anymore, and headed towards Okinawa. So now I've got all these daggum squadrons here, so I got some of them back to Clark, some of them back to Mactan, and held off on the other ones and brought them up to Tachikawa. Sitting there pretty good, and that thing came north, right straight for us. Now I was confronted with other problems, because I had other people's aircraft I had some CIA aircraft. These people don't like the idea of you pushing them around, but anyway, I gave the officer, he would stay here, but I said, I'm evacuating my squadron out of here right now. Oh, well, it's okay. Sayonara, woman. So, but it came up and it hit Tachikawa and tore the heck out of a couple of hangars and it tore the tail off of one of the CIA aircraft. And I just waved and said, told you. But anyway, we got through it okay, but it was just the idea that when the monsoon hits, it's not as predictable, I think, as the ones that hit Florida or South Carolina, because they project exactly where, approximately where it's going to go. But they're known. It just wanders around. And it's pretty horrendous. It's pretty widespread.
That's one of the striking things I've heard about is the monsoons in Vietnam and just how miserable it is being out there in them.
12 inches of rain in a period of 4 hours, which I had never seen rain like that before. It was like somebody was sailing over you with a bucket of water just pouring on you. It played havoc with the security. We were sort of in a basin, you might say, but we had wire fences all the way around, protection all the way, until the water rose above the fences and the VC floated in above the fences and attacked us. You know, so that was the monsoon attack. And you can't defend against it. You get suck all the water up and then shoot them. So, but they were horrible. Now I say that having never been through a monsoon, if you will, in Florida, or the one that hit Louisiana.
Yeah, the hurricanes.
So. I would imagine it's the same thing.
Oh yeah, that the visibility even, like being
there
able to,
not.
Yeah, there is no visibility, so you're trying to defend against something that you can't see.
You can't see.
Yeah, you can't see.
You know they're there.
Yeah.
But then they know you're there, so.
Yeah. Another thing that kind of made me smile was the fact that your units threw you a surprise party for your sending off.
Yeah. Oh, that's a choker. I got my rotation orders, and first thing I did, I called in. The second thing I did was, I didn't call the first sergeant. He knew he's the one who gave it to me. You're leaving tomorrow morning. Well, where am I going? We're going home. He said, now don't worry about it, sir. He said, I'll take care of it. He said, your plane leaves at like 9 o'clock in the morning. He said, the truck will be out at your barracks by 8 o'clock or something, well, I forget which. He said, just throw your bags on there. I'll take you out to the airplane and that'll be in. I said, okay, sounds good. Went out to my quarters, my office, so to speak, and told a couple people, the sergeant, some of the ranking sergeants, and I was leaving, shook their hand, thanked, hugs. But anyway, the sergeant was there first thing in the morning, threw my bag in there, and said, we had a couple people in the barracks that were there. The chaplain, who was glad to see me go, but that's another story. But anyway, went up to the flight line. We have an air terminal there where you would wait for your flight and all this stuff. So he dropped me off right in front of it, and the aircraft was sitting there. It was a jet, a little jet, called a scat pack. One of these things that fly. Anyway, He said, well, sir, he said, this is it, sergeant. No, no, all, everything military. Now walk past the corner of the building. The roadway was here. I walked past the corner of the building, and my troops, every one of them, except the ones that were up flying, were lined up in dress order fashion, in a rigid brace. And Sergeant Payton said, we'd like to have you inspect the troops, sir. And I did. Upon completion of which, one turns around and salutes the flag and salutes the troops. And then I go on my airplane. And I think I cried all the way to Tonsonute. Oh boy. No, these guys were just wonderful. You know, they really were. And I respected every one of them, down to my drug boy. But it was hard to leave. It really was. The pilot turned around and said, sir, you're the only one I ever saw crying leaving Vietnam.
You liked your boys. You had a good
time. Oh, yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah. But once you're out, you're out. And with the exception of the two guys that stopped over here, there's been no contact with anyone. You in a way, you want to remember them, but you don't want to associate closely. I mean, they all had different lives. They all had different worlds to go back to, as did I. But I made no attempt to get together. I hate reunions. I really do, for many reasons. But no, I'd like to see him, sure. I really would, but I'm not going to get together, let's all go to Vegas and have a party, no. That doesn't work for me. But anyway, we got through that okay.
I do have to ask, you mentioned the chaplain. You kind of made that side note. I have to know now. Like, what is the deal with the chaplain? You got to tell me that story.
We had a Baptist chaplain. Now, a chapel in the service, all branches, is interdenominational. I mean, it's the chaplain gives Jewish rites and Catholic last rites and the whole bit. But this guy, being Baptist, and I don't know how this is going to come across, because we were all going to hell anyway, and he figured there's not a heck of a lot he can do about that, you know. And he and I had words a couple times about this and that and everything, and I said, and I told him, I said, you know, I don't want you preaching that way to my troops. I said, they need their morale built up. They need to be reminded of the mission here. They need this, they need that. They don't need the fire and brimstone bit. I said, they have enough to worry about, you know. Well, no, you know, it's I said, no. I said, I'm revoking your clearance. Now, to get into my area, get into our area, excuse me, it was guarded by a chain link fence, and of course we had barbed wire, raising wire, and everything else. Even the base commander was not allowed in my area, which made him mad. There wasn't anything I could do about it. I said, well, you call my boss in Washington and tell him about it, you know? Well, which he never did, or if he did, he got chewed out for it. But anyway. And the chaplain was the same way. He wanted to come into my area, and I said, no, sir, you cannot. You do not have clearance to come into my area. My clearance comes from above, and that really got me. You know? And I said, well, I'm as religious a man as you're going to find on this base. But I said, I have rules and regulations, as do you. Yours are in the Bible and mine are in my manual. And my manual, in this case, trumps your Bible. Oh, boy. So anyway, no, we we didn't have words. Although, I will say that I did sing in the choir and eventually lead the choir in the chapel, for which I got a plaque. You know, oh, I had to laugh when I got that. It was presented to me. Anyway,
I was like, did your chaplain friend present it to you?
No, it was his successor, who was a Catholic priest. God love him. Every place, base I was on, I would meet all the chaplains, and I befriended all of them, but more so the Catholic. I don't know why. It was just, they didn't look down on anyone, you know.
Yeah.
And but the one there in Vietnam, he was a piece of work. He really was. But he wanted to go up in our airplanes, and I said, I'd love to have you, chaplain, but I said, I can't because you're not cleared.
Yeah.
And I expected the same thing from him. But he said, okay. I don't think you really wanted to go up that. But anyway, no, I don't know what religion you are, but you know, I just fell in love with the Catholic chaplains. Father Hurdley, well, anyway, that's another base and another story, but he was a character. He was the one. We were in Turkey. This has nothing to do with Vietnam. We were in Turkey, and Father Early, we had a party. And, of course, I was invited to the chapel. But anyway, he came over, which quiets things down considerably when the chaplain of any religion walks into your highfalutin party. And he got pretty well soused. And in doing such, spilled his drink all over an upright piano that we had just acquired, secondhand though it may be. But, and then sat down and started playing something or other, you know. He was an accomplished musician. He was an accomplished BSer too, but, no, Father Hurley and I would, I'd take him anywhere. But anyway, no, that was my chaplain story from Vietnam.
You can't mention that the chaplain was happy to see you go and then just leave it at that. I was gonna let you off that easy.
That's good interviewing.
And I'm actually let's take a bit of a brief break, and I have a few more questions, but